So this is a bunch of slides that I took from the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, which, you know, they luckily provided this whole set of beautiful slides for us. In a set of work that they did called Sleep Alertness and Fatigue Education in Residency, SAFER. Okay, next. Okay, so our goals for today are to have you list the factors that put you at risk for sleepiness and fatigue, describe the impact of sleep loss on your personal and professional lives, recognize the signs of sleepiness and fatigue, challenge misconceptions about sleep and sleep loss, and to adapt management programs so that you can actually deal with sleepiness for you and for the residency. I'd like to just tell you one quick thing. If you see this picture on the side here, this is one of our former residents who left the hospital after night float, after refusing to trade calls with other residents, and he drove to Philadelphia to take the boards, and he apparently fell asleep and hit a tree, and so I'd kind of like to dedicate this talk to Dr. Barbalescu. Next slide, please. Okay, so does this look like anybody you know? Okay. Talk about how brainwashing used to take place, right? You starved people and you sleep deprived them. And then you got them to believe anything that you said. Okay? This is what residency is like. Next slide. Okay, but even though this is our attitude, we really underestimate the scope of the problem. Next. Okay, so this was a study that was done in about 2002 where they used the Epworth Sleepiness Scale. And if you take a look at this graph, it shows that the level of sleepiness in a normal resident ranges somewhere between patients with sleep apnea and patients with narcolepsy. It's a little bit scary, don't you think? Okay, next slide. Okay, so why is this? We really don't know a lot about sleep and sleep pathology. It's not something that we generally teach, although you can do fellowships in sleep now. Not a lot is known about it. We can't do drug testing for sleepiness. I mean, I think we pretty much recognize what a sleepy person looks like, but it's kind of hard to really pin it down. Most programs don't address problems of resident sleepiness. Okay? And, I mean, I know when I was a resident, sleep was really an optional thing. Sleep, you know, there are only so many hours in a week, and if you have something you need to do, you just sleep less. And we were also taught that you had to be strong. God forbid anything would come in the way of you and your patients. If you had to sleep, you were a wimp. Okay? So less sleep means you're more dedicated. Next slide. Okay. So what causes sleepiness? Anybody have any idea? Not enough sleep. There's a pretty good thing. Other things?
Your body telling you need more REM, and your body needs to have some downtime. So your body is saying, I can take a break.
Because you haven't had enough sleep, right? Okay, but you brought up REM sleep. Okay, so we're talking about the quality of sleep also. So it's not just not enough sleep, but it's getting good sleep. Okay, next slide. Okay, it's the really boring noon conferences just like this that put me to sleep. Okay, believe it or not, I'm not the one putting you to sleep now. If you're falling asleep, as many of you are, it's really the environmental factors that unmask sleepiness, but they don't cause sleepiness. So the fact that the lights went out right away, that's, you know, a cue to your body that it's time to sleep, if you're sleepy. If you're not sleepy, you're not going to fall asleep no matter how boring I am. Next. Okay. So what are the factors that go into excessive daytime sleepiness? Insufficient sleep. Okay, so that's when you're on call, you have inadequate recovery sleep, which we'll talk about. After you've slept enough, you need to sleep more. Fragmented sleep, that beeper of yours that keeps going off every time you try to close your eyes. Okay, circadian rhythm disruption, and anybody who's ever flown across time zones will know about this. But night float, rotating shifts, really wreak havoc with your circadian rhythms, as well as primary sleep disorders like sleep apnea, narcolepsy, things of that sort. Okay, next. Okay, so how much sleep do you really need? So here's a myth. I'm one of those people who only needs 5 hours of sleep, so none of this applies to me. Have any of you ever heard yourself saying things like this? Anybody? No? Okay. Okay, the fact is that although we all vary somewhat in the amount of sleep that we need, pretty much everybody needs 8 hours of sleep, not much more, and certainly not much less. The other thing that we know is that we don't judge this very well for ourselves.
Okay? Does it change with age? I've heard that as you get older, you need less sleep.
It actually does change with age, and the quality of sleep changes with age. There are a lot of studies about this. If you look at infants, children sleep incredibly well, right? They can sleep through anything. They sleep a lot. Unless they're my children, in which case they sleep for about an hour and then scream all night. But if you think about it from an evolutionary perspective, it makes a lot of sense. When you're a young kid, your body is exceptionally metabolically active and needs a lot of rest. The brain uses up something like 20% at normal wakefulness, not running around. The brain uses 20% of the energy of the body. So for the body to be able to have enough energy to grow and mature, you have to sort of put the brain to rest. Babies sleep incredibly well. And in terms of an evolutionary perspective, you know, why do they need to sleep lightly? They can sleep because they've got parents there to take care of them. But anybody who's a first-time parent will know that you can sleep through a thunderstorm, but if that baby makes even the tiniest little noise, you're going to be up in a second. So already your sleep is not as deep as it once was, because evolutionarily you need to be there to protect the baby. Okay? As you get older, your body isn't as metabolically active. It doesn't need the rest that it once did. Becomes much more efficient. So, you know, over time, you definitely do need less. Okay? But that doesn't mean, you know, between being an intern and being a resident. That's 20, 30 years. Okay? Next slide. Okay. Next. Okay? So getting less than 8 hours of sleep starts to create a sleep debt, okay? And that has to be repaid. With each night that you're getting less and less sleep, by the time you reach the weekend and you finally have your night off, you're going to be exhausted and you're going to need to sleep a lot. Anybody you know? Okay. Okay? So I think, you know, anybody who's traveled to a different country will probably realize that when you've got jet lag, it's easier to stay up longer than to try to go to sleep earlier, to try to get over the jet lag. Okay? So it's easier to adapt to shifts in a forward direction than backward. And you'll see the way the ER schedules are made. They'll have you first on days, then on, you know, evenings, then on overnights, because it really is easier to push yourself forward that way. Okay? So sometimes if somebody's a night owl, they might find it easier to adapt to a night float schedule than the rest of us. Next. Okay. And obviously we can all have sleep disorders as well. Obstructive sleep apnea, restless legs. Okay, insomnia, and we are not immune to medication-induced insomnia as well. Next slide. Okay, so restless leg syndrome. It's a whole separate lecture. It's a syndrome in which people try to go to bed at night and their legs start moving and they can't sleep because their legs are, they have to get up, they have to walk around. Okay. So I've learned not to need as much sleep during my residency. What do you guys think about that? True, false? Okay, very, very false. Next. Okay. Sleep needs are genetically determined. Okay, not residency determined. We can't really change them. We don't adapt to getting more less sleep than we need. Okay? A lot of people think that they do better when they're sleep deprived. But actually, the studies have really not shown that. Performance of tasks may improve because you concentrate, because you're so exhausted. But optimal performance and consistency of performance absolutely do not improve. Okay?
So what... Performance of tasks improve, but not optimal performance improves.
I'm sorry? Say that again?
What does it mean, performance of tasks improve, but not optimal performance?
So you can do a specific thing like putting in an IV, but if you are constantly putting in these IVs, you're not going to be consistent with it. You're not going to do them as well necessarily. Okay. And I've got, there are a bunch of studies that have actually borne these things out, although they're not all quoted. So the consequences of chronic sleep deprivation, okay? Just like hunger and thirst, you really need to meet sleep demands. Next slide. Okay, so here's all of the different spheres of that you're going to impact if you're sleep deprived. Okay, relationships with other people, whether that's at work, when people are cranky and they're sniping at the nurses or each other, or when you go home and you take it out on your spouse. Driving safety, patient care, professionalism, mood, okay? Your learning is going to be impacted. Who's going to go home exhausted and say, I got to open Harrison's and read another few pages? I'll open Harrison's and my head will be in it in a split second. Okay, so there are a lot of issues that sleep deprivation affects. Next. Okay, so here are some studies. And it's actually pretty interesting. The first real study that I was able to track was published in the New England Journal in, I think it was 71. It was called The Intern and Sleep Loss, okay? And that study showed that interns made almost twice as many errors reading EKGs after an extended work shift, which I think was 24 hours or more, than after when they hadn't had a night of sleep, okay? Surgery, 20% more errors, I think, what does that say, occurring? And 14% more time required to perform simulated laparoscopies post-call. There was a study in 2001, another study in 2003. And there have been more since then. It's actually pretty fascinating. I don't know about in other places, but I know Montefiore, Jacoby. The interns get to go to the OR when they're post-call. That's kind of a reward for staying up all night. They may have changed this. But this is when we're sending people to the operating room, and this is when they perform worse. Okay? The medicine EKG interpretation, it says 1994, but this is as far back as 71. Okay? Pediatrics, the time required to place an intra-arterial line increased significantly in sleep-deprived people. Okay? Next. Okay, let me just tell you about this other study. It's called the Harvard Work Hours Health and Safety Study, which took place in interns from, I think, July 2002 until June of 2003, in which they did a number of interventions in different areas, mostly in the MICU and CCU, where they took the traditional call schedule, which was every third night, and then they had their intervention was a changed call schedule in which they had interns on daytimes and then interns at night. Okay? It was published in the New England Journal in 2004. I think there were subsequent studies in 2005 in New England Journal. Okay? The average work week, they said, was 77 to 81 hours and up to 34 continuous hours of scheduled work with the traditional schedule. Okay, the interventional schedule had no calls more than 24 hours, and I think they had no more than it was no more than 16 hours straight of work. And they had physician observers who followed the interns. So the data was pretty interesting. The interns made 36% more serious medical errors during traditional schedule. 36%. Okay, 28% more than were intercepted. 56, 57% more non-intercepted serious errors. And it's a little confusing the way they did this, but because they had physicians following them around, a lot of the things were intercepted. Most of them were intercepted by the residents because they didn't change the resident schedule. But just in terms of the raw data of the interns making these errors, it's pretty staggering, okay? The errors were more likely to be serious medication errors, something like 21%, and diagnostic errors, 5.6 times as many diagnostic errors in the traditional group. Okay? That's an astounding number. I still have one of our nurses teasing me from when I was an intern when I wrote a Tylenol IV Soluset order. You know, it could have been a lot more dangerous than that. But the nurse was there to pick it up, and we have a lot of checks and balances in place to try to protect from these things. But the real issue is, why are we making these mistakes in the first place? Okay? So, across tasks. Emergency medicine, significant reductions in the comprehensiveness of the history and physical exam documentation. Okay, next. And in family medicine, the board scores in the in-service exam were negatively correlated with pre-test sleep amounts. And I know for a fact, when I took the first time I took the in-service exam, I was post-call. I sat down in the room. They handed me my paper. I filled out my name. I filled out the little boxes for my birth date and everything else. And the next thing I knew, somebody was shaking me and telling me I had to hand my paper in. And so I just scribbled in. I never saw the exam. I just scribbled little, you know, I filled in all the circles. And then I got called into the chairman's office because my scores were so atrocious, worse than if I had just guessed, which I had. I did so terribly, and I said, well, I didn't really take the test. I was unconscious for the entire thing. Okay, but you know how it is. When you're sleep-deprived, when you're sitting there, you have to keep going back over everything that you were doing. You have to keep checking because you just can't focus as much. Okay, next. So what's the impact on professionalism? Your patients become the enemy because they are one thing that stands between you and a few hours of sleep. Okay. These are quotes from residents, by the way. Next slide. Okay, so if you take a look at this, the colors didn't come out quite right, but the light blue shows the number of work hours per week. The bottom axis is the number of hours of sleep. And if you take a look, the open boxes, the percent reporting serious medical errors clearly goes down with the number of hours of increased numbers of sleep and fewer work hours. Okay? And the percent that reported serious staff conflicts, this was all a survey that was sent to, I forgot what they said, something like 3,000 residents, but don't quote me on that. The dark boxes at the bottom, the percent reporting serious staff conflicts. Okay? Staff conflicts go down when you sleep more. Staff conflicts go down when you work less. Okay? Next slide. Okay? The bottom line is you need to be alert to take the best possible care of the patients as well as yourself. Next. Okay. So what happens to your patients? What happens to you when you don't get enough sleep? Percent reporting significant weight change is the light blue boxes. Okay? You have decreased change in weight when you sleep more and you work less. The percent reporting medicines used to stay awake are the white boxes, okay, that also decreases. And the percent reporting increased alcohol use also decreases. So people tend to drink a lot when they're not sleeping well and when they're working too much. Okay, next. Okay, so safety issues. 58% of emergency medicine residents reported near crashes driving. 80% of these were after a night shift. Okay, and it increased, the rate increased with the number of night shifts per month. There's also a 50% greater risk of bloodborne pathogen exposure during the night shift. Okay, it's interesting actually, there was a study in 1997 that was published in Nature, okay, which showed that a single night of continuous sleep deprivation caused the same decrement in performance as a blood alcohol of 0.1. Okay, so Luckily, they can't do blood tests for this, or we would all be arrested for drunk driving, right? Okay, next slide.
It's interesting that it's like post-night shift, like at least it's during daylight. You think like driving during the night is a lot more dangerous.
Part of the problem, though, is going to be the circadian rhythms. If you're working at night, you're generally not sleeping so well in the daytime. And we'll talk a little bit about that, but you know that is true. Okay, so how does this impact medical education? Okay, it's very well known that you stop learning after 12 or 14 hours. People feel that they learn to cut corners. That's what you're learning as a resident, and it's a little frightening that that's what we're teaching you. Okay, next. Okay, and residents who work longer hours report decreased satisfaction with learning, decreased motivation to learn. And a study in surgical residents showed less operative participation that associated with being on call more often. Next slide. So medical errors. This is a survey that they did. More than 60% of anesthesiologists report making fatigue-related errors. And if you look at the numbers at the bottom, okay, post-op surgical complication rates were 45% and higher if the resident was post-call. Scary, scary numbers. Next slide. So how do you recognize sleepiness? Look around the room. How do you recognize it? Okay. If I can just get through the night on call, I'm fine in the morning. Okay. So decline in performance has been shown to occur after 15 to 16 hours of continued wakefulness. Okay, and the period of lowest alertness is between 6 a.m. and 11 a.m., which corresponds exactly with morning rounds. Next slide. Okay, I can tell how tired I am, and I know when I'm not functioning up to par. This also is not true. Okay, the studies show that sleepy people underestimate their level of sleepiness and overestimate their alertness. The sleepier you are, the less accurate your perception of the degree of impairment. Okay? And have any of you ever had a microsleep? When you're sitting on rounds and your head just kind of drops, or seen it in other people? I learned when I was a resident to sit and lean on my hand over a desk with a pen in my hand like this, because if I fell asleep, I would drop the pen and it would wake me up. So maybe the attending wouldn't catch on. Okay, here, back to anesthesia. The residents didn't perceive themselves to be asleep almost half the time that they had actually fallen asleep. Okay, the residents were wrong 76% of the time when they reported having stayed awake. Okay, so next time any of you or your family members have to go for an operation, think about it. Your anesthesiologist is probably falling asleep. Okay, next. Recognize the warning signs. Falling asleep of conferences or in rounds. Feeling restless and irritable with staff, colleagues, family, and friends. Having to check your work repeatedly. Having difficulty focusing on the care of your patients. And feeling like you just don't care. Next slide. Okay. So the big problem is if you don't recognize it, you're not going to do anything about it. Okay, so what are we going to do to fix this? Is this it? Here's the myth. I'd rather just power through when I'm tired. Besides, even when I can nap, it just makes me feel worse. Okay, so the fact is that some sleep is better than no sleep. The question is, how are you going to get this sleep? Now, I remember very clearly, I was just telling the story yesterday, when I was an intern, we were on 20, this was already in the days of the Bell Commission, which took place in the late 80s, thanks to Dr. Bell. Okay, we were on call 24 hours. We technically were able to sign out to a day float after we were up all night. We had to go to attending rounds, we had to write our notes, and then we could leave. We routinely stayed till 5, 6 o'clock the next afternoon, and this is after the Bell Commission was in effect with Dr. Bell here. Okay, this was routine for us. And I remember, so that was every third or every fourth night, depending where you were. Okay? We were exhausted. We were chronically exhausted. But I remember one night when I was on call, it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. I had never even seen the inside of a call room. And it was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was a quiet night. My friend said to me, "You know, come on, let's just go to sleep," which I had never done, because there's always work that you could do. So we went, she showed me where the call room was at the end of 4 East, and we walked into the call room, and there were bunk beds there. She got in the bottom bunk, I got in the top bunk, and I had never been on a bunk bed before. And the second my head hit the pillow, I was out cold. About 3 seconds after that, our beepers went off, there was a code. The next thing I knew, my friend was on the floor. It was like out of a cartoon. She had gone splat on the floor. I was on top of her because I fell off the top bunk and landed on top of her. Our glasses had gone flying. We were crawling around on the floor, our arms and legs getting all intertwined, looking for our shoes, looking for our glasses. And I swore that never, ever again was I going to sleep on call. Okay? It was a nightmare. Ultimately, I learned that you just don't take your shoes off and you don't sleep on the top bunk. Okay? So next slide. Okay, so let's talk about napping a little bit. 3-second naps don't work. Okay, but the pros. Naps temporarily improve alertness. Okay, so you could have your preventative nap before you're on call, or your operational nap, which is while you're on the job. Okay? So how long are these naps supposed to take place? Short naps are defined as less than 30 minutes to avoid what they call sleep inertia that occurs when you're awakened from deep sleep. Long naps are generally 2 hours, range from 30 to 180 minutes. Now, this whole sleep inertia thing is a pretty interesting phenomenon. Sleep inertia, this grogginess after you wake up, is actually related to the depth of sleep. So if you have barely fallen asleep, so it's within the first 30 minutes or so, you're able to get up, you're able to function. But if you sleep for an hour, you know, it's going to take you 15 minutes to half an hour to really get back up to normal, your normal abilities. Okay, next slide. So if possible, take advantage of the circadian window of opportunity. So the best time to really nap is exactly when you feel like you need it. It's 2 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon when you can't keep your eyes open, or when you're on call, 2 to 5 o'clock in the morning. Okay? The cons, as we talked about, the sleep inertia, you need to allow adequate recovery time. And the bottom line is that naps take the edge off. They don't really substitute for sleep. Doesn't replace adequate sleep. But if you're feeling exhausted, it's way better to take a 20-minute nap than to try to power through. Okay, next slide. Okay, so healthy sleep habits. Try to get 7 to 9 hours of sleep before you're planning to lose sleep. You want to avoid starting out with a sleep deficit. Okay, you need to go into a night on call very well rested. Next. Okay, so recovery from sleep loss. The myth: all I need is my usual 5 to 6 hours the night after call and I'm fine. Okay, the fact is that recovery from on-call sleep loss takes a good 2 nights of serious extended sleep. Okay, recovery sleep has a higher percentage of deep sleep, which you need to counteract the effects of sleep loss. Next. Okay, so this was a study that they did in anesthesia residents where they just showed that their sleepiness post-call compared to, the sleepiness level post-call, which is the pink one, versus on a normal schedule, which is the light blue, equivalent in anesthesia residents. The extended sleep on top normalized post-call sleepiness levels. Okay, next slide. All right. So what are healthy sleep habits? These are good for you, not just for our patients. Okay? Go to bed and get up about the same time every day. Develop a routine before you go to bed. Okay? Use relaxation to help you fall asleep. And protect your sleep time. Enlist your family and friends. So tell the babies they're not allowed to wake up during the night screaming. It's harder to be a new parent than an intern. Okay, next. Okay. Sleeping environment, you should generally have cooler temperatures. It should be dark. Use eye shades, room darkening shades if you have to. And try to turn off your phone, earplugs, white noise machine. You need to have a nice, soothing, spa-like environment. Okay, you don't want to go to bed hungry, but you don't want to eat like a pig before you go to bed either. Okay, and regular exercise, but no heavy exercise before, 3 hours before bed. Next. Okay, have any of you ever fallen asleep while you're driving? Got a couple here? Okay. This is another thing that I tend to do. I actually, post-call one day, fell asleep on the Long Island Expressway. When I fell asleep, I was in the left lane, and I woke up in the right lane. Don't know how I got there. Miraculously, I didn't kill anybody. Okay? So what are the signs? You have trouble focusing on the road. You have difficulty keeping your eyes open. You start nodding. You yawn repeatedly. Okay? You drift from your lane, missing signs or exits. You don't remember driving the last few miles. You close your eyes at stoplights. Okay? So what do you do if this is happening? Yeah, you park your car, you get a nap. Okay, what else do people do?
Continue driving.
Yeah, that's okay. That would be a bad thing to do.
Yeah.
Okay. Caffeine. We'll talk about any other ideas.
Turning up the music
doesn't work. What else?
Open the window.
Another thing that doesn't work, and we do this. Other ideas? Turn up the air conditioning, open the window in the freezing cold, you fall asleep through it anyway.
Change lanes more often.
Change lanes more often? I don't know how that would help. I don't know. Okay. I mean, if you're really tired, you should definitely sleep before you leave. Talk to someone on the phone. You know, I recently did that. I was driving back from Baltimore at 4 o'clock in the morning because I needed to be here in time for rounds, and I didn't know what to do because who do you call at 5 a.m.? You can't. You know, there aren't too many people to call unless you're manic, in which case you call everybody. The only thing that saved me, other than Starbucks, was that I realized if I called Israel, they were 7 hours ahead. And I sat on the phone, on my cell phone, talking to Israel in the afternoon at 5 o'clock in the morning. It worked. It worked beautifully. The sun finally came up and I was awake. Okay, next slide. Okay, so the risk factors are taking any kind of sedating medications, any kind of alcohol use. Obviously, sleep disorders, driving long distances on boring roads like the New Jersey Turnpike without brakes, and driving alone. Okay? So if you take a look at this graph at the bottom, you can see the worst times to drive. Okay? Between 6 and 9 in the morning and after, 4, 5, 6 o'clock at night. Those are definitely associated with more driving accidents. Which would be a non-boring road. When you're that tired, everything is boring.
And you're more likely to have an accident. There's not a lot of traffic. So if you're getting out 7, 8, where there's still a lot of people, you're more likely to fall asleep and hit somebody if you're driving a lot of traffic. It's better to focus on the roads.
Right. At least you're not going to kill anybody else while you're killing yourself. But it is hard. Stop and go traffic is, even when you're likely to cause an accident. I actually fell asleep once while driving and had an accident 2 blocks from my house. I had a micro sleep. The only reason I didn't get a ticket was because the road was covered with ice and everybody was having accidents, so they assumed that, the car skidded and it wasn't my fault. I hit one of my neighbor's parked cars. And I had no idea, I thought it was a different name. When I hit, I thought, oh my God, I hit my friend's car. I was about 4 houses down from where my friend had been parked. I don't know what happened. I was out. It was one of those micro sleep things. Okay? Next slide. Okay, so the only real answer is don't drive if you're drowsy. Don't take any chances. You're risking your life. You're risking the lives of others. Okay, if you're really sleepy, you know, be smart about it. Get somebody to drive you. Call a cab. Sleep it off in the call room. Use public transportation. Take a nap before you leave. Have coffee before you go home. And coffee isn't going to last that long, okay? Stop driving if you notice any of the warning signs that we talked about. Pull off the road and take a nap at a safe place. Okay? Next slide. Okay, so what doesn't work? All the things we talked about. Turning up the radio, opening the car window, chewing gum, blowing cold air or water on your face, slapping yourself, promising yourself a reward for staying awake. So none of these things work. Next slide. Okay, it only takes a 4-second lapse in attention to have a drowsy driving crash, which is what I did. I don't even think it was 4 seconds. Okay, and I was driving like 10 miles an hour and I managed to wreck my car. Next slide. Okay, so, you know, you might think about melatonin. We talk about this for use in people who have jet lag. Okay, there's really no data for this in residents. Any kind of hypnotics, possibly in certain types of insomnia, it might be worth it occasionally, but generally you don't want to use any kind of hypnotic. You don't want to use any stimulants to stay awake. And alcohol is really bad. It'll help you fall asleep, but it's going to really mess with your sleep quality. So alcohol is a bad option. Next slide. So what's the story with caffeine? There were a lot of studies that were done in, you know, around 2004. There was a specific study that I'm thinking about that was done, that was published in the journal Sleep in 2004. The important thing about caffeine is strategic consumption, okay? It works within 15 to 30 minutes, and it lasts for 3 to 7 hours, but doesn't do that much for you. It works temporarily. I think a lot of that also has to do with the fact if you're actively drinking, that also helps to keep you awake. Okay, the problems with caffeine, it disrupts subsequent sleep. You have many more arousals in sleep studies. You can become tolerant to caffeine. And the diuretic effects, which actually I think are beneficial if all you're thinking about is that you have to get home so you can go to the bathroom. It might help you stay awake a little bit. Okay, next. Okay, so how do you adapt to night shifts? I don't know about you guys, but I think night float was by far the worst rotation that I had. You know, you have 2 weeks of night float. It took me about a week to finally get used to the night schedule, and then I only had another week before I had to go back to days. Okay, so myth. I get used to night shifts right away, no problem. Okay, fact. Takes at least a week for circadian rhythms and sleep patterns to adjust. Okay, adjustment often includes physical and mental symptoms. And again, it's the shift rotation that's important. So you want to move forward with your sleep pattern rather than backwards. So, keys to surviving night float. Protect your sleep. Nap before you go to work. I mean, ideally, you're sleeping in the daytime before you go to your night float, so you should be well rested, but that doesn't usually happen. You can consider splitting the sleep into 2 4-hour periods. While you're on call, you want as much bright light as possible to try to keep you awake. And the last one is a little questionable to me. You want to avoid light exposure in the morning after night shift. Now that's great because you don't want to really wake up enough, you know, wake up that much so that you can't sleep when you get home. But it's a little frightening to think that you're trying to put on sunglasses and dark glasses and things so that while you're driving. So it's always better to find an alternative way to get home in the morning. Next slide. Okay, so this is actually interesting. The impact of night float coverage. Okay, now what they're calling night float coverage in these studies isn't what we have, the night float system that we have, that the night float covers the hospital and everybody else works in the daytime. They're actually having a night float come in to do all of your cross coverage while you're still there pretty much taking care of your own patients, working overnight. Okay? So that's what they're referring to as the protected interns, the ones who don't have to do the cross coverage, but they're in the hospital. What they showed, though, is interesting. The protected interns slept less than the controls. They used time to catch up on work, not sleep. Okay? So even though they're giving you a night float so that you don't have to work as hard, people aren't going to sleep. They're staying up, and they're trying to do their work, trying to get other things done. Okay, so there's no improvement in performance. I looked back to some of the studies that were done after the institution of the Bell Commission in the late 80s, and it was actually very interesting. They showed that there's one specific article in JAMA in 1993. Even though there were decreased work hours, there was more cross coverage because you don't have people in the hospital as long, so everybody is covering everybody else. And obviously there were studies with a lot of these, there were problems with a lot of these studies because they were unblinded, they were retrospective studies, but they show that the efficiency of the care declined and the complications increased with the institution of the Bell Commission. Okay? So it's interesting, even though we're trying to control the amount of sleep, we weren't doing a very good job. We're doing things very differently now, and now we have much better studies to show what works and what doesn't work. Next slide. Okay, so what are the alertness strategies? You have to realize that there are no magic bullets to fix this. You have to know your own vulnerability to sleep loss. You have to learn what works for you. And there needs to be a shared responsibility for fatigue management, and we need to help each other. There has to be a culture of support, they call it, in the training program. Okay? So everybody needs to take care of each other. If you notice that somebody is nodding off, send them to bed for a few minutes, you know, for half an hour or so, cover for them, because it's dangerous for all of us. And I can promise you, if you do it for your friends, people will do it for you as well. Okay, next slide. Okay, fatigue is an impairment, very similar to drugs and alcohol. We can't eliminate it, but we can manage it. You need to recognize sleepiness and fatigue, and you have to know about management strategies. When sleepiness is interfering with your performance or health, you have to talk to your supervisors and program director. Okay? Next slide. Okay? See your local sleep education advocate. Okay? This is the website, but please, you know, talk to us if there's a problem, if you're having any problems. Comments, questions? Okay. Thanks.